From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. What are we supposed to do with all these Confederate monuments and memorials throughout the country, South? The question erupts from time to time. The latest came from the White House Chief of Staff General John Kelly, who said the Civil War started because Americans failed to compromise. He called General Robert E. Lee a noble man who had given up his country to fight for his state. Well, the historian David Blight says Kelly's comments and many of the arguments made for keeping Confederate statues and the flag are based on what is often called the lost cause narrative. It's the idea that the war was just a misunderstanding among honorable people. Blight says the idea has been around for a long time, and it's mostly wrong. But there's a reason the narrative won't go away. Blight is joining us today to explain after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They've been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for care in all 10 pediatric specialties, including heart, orthopedics, neurology, and cancer. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The question of what caused the American Civil War is still contested among historians and scholars. Was it a fight about states' rights? Was it about the encroachment of the federal government? Was it rooted in complex economic forces? Well, most everyone who studies the war agrees those were important parts of the story. But the historian David Blight says it's not overly simplistic to say the Civil War was mostly about slavery. And if it was mostly about one side trying to preserve slavery and another trying to abolish it, it makes it so much more difficult to argue that the monuments and the banners of the Confederacy are worth celebrating, let alone allowing them to remain standing or flying. The issue came up a few weeks ago when the White House Chief of Staff General John Kelly said the Civil War was a failure of compromise and that Robert E. Lee was not a traitor to his country, but a noble warrior for his state. The Yale historian David Blight says Kelly's comments are rooted in an old notion, a notion of reconciliation that came from the late 19th century and the early 20th. The problem is, Blight says, it's a misreading of what actually happened. But it does tell us something about the difference between memory and history. We asked Professor Blight to join us to talk about it. He's a public historian, teaches American history at Yale University. Among his books are Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory. He joined us from the studios on the Yale campus. And that difference between history and memory, that's where we began the conversation.
Well, history tends to be what historians do. That is the scholarship, the research, the writing, of everything from monographs to textbooks. It's a reasoned reconstruction of the past rooted in research. It's also schooling and teaching. Yeah. We like to think that, you know, the best history is taught in classrooms through textbooks, through all kinds of materials. Now, that is not to suggest that historians have a lot of control over that.
Right.
Memory, however, tends to be the stories and the narratives, versions of the past passed down through generations by families, by, to some extent, schooling, by churches, by popular culture, by literature, and, of course, now in the medium of film and social media. Memory becomes the stories and the narratives and the versions of the past that we want to live in or believe we live in. Mm. And these two can complement one another, but they often are these two streams kind of flowing in opposite directions in the same river.
Yeah.
And another key point here, there is far more memory than there is the history we write.
Hmm.
Every person walking around outside this building here or the building you're in has a sense of the past of some kind in their heads. They got it by a variety of means. We are about the business of trying to give them good history to base those memories on.
You quote the French historian Pierre Nora in one of your books, who said,
yeah,
memory dictates while history writes.
Yes, that's true. Nora was, of course, when he was writing, he was very exercised about what he perceived as the lack of French interest, this is back in the 1970s, in their own history, in their own great monuments, in memorializing their revolution. And he wrote particularly poignantly about this difference between history and memory. History is always cautioning us. History is always a bit skeptical. It's whereas memory, it's like mythology in a sense. It just exists. It's the stories we take in. Sometimes we're not even conscious of how we come up with our consciousness of the past, of how we come up with our memories. We just know we heard it somehow from a grandparent, from schooling, from television. It's full of often must have beens or might have beens and all the rest. Now, I'm not trying to take, the glorious high ground here for historians. I'm merely trying to describe the difference in these two ways that we get access to the past. And there's a danger, of course, that memory can take over for history.
Yeah.
And in the end, you have versions of the past that are not based on facts, research, or that strange thing called truth. And that's where we have lots of conflict. And we're living in a new age again right now of this problem of whether people want to even believe in the works of elites like academic historians.
You write about, and I was really interested in, memory is used, you say, as an instrument of power.
Oh, indeed. It always has been. It's been used that way by virtually every civilization in history. What nations do when they create themselves is usually they create their founding myth or their founding story. Then they develop a narrative of who they are. Sometimes those narratives are about peoplehood, sometimes about a culture, sometimes about race, sometimes about nationalism, especially in the modern era. And Americans, of course, have not been novices at this. We've come of age as a country, well over 200 years old now, that believes somehow that our history is a pursuit of improvement and progress and betterment and a place where almost everybody can simply make it better, and our history is somehow a history that may have its troubles, but we solve our problems. We may have tragedies, but we overcome them, which sometimes prevents us from actually even looking closely at our tragedies and our failures, because in the end, we want them all to serve a narrative of progress. And sometimes that's just not the way history happens.
So I hope this isn't too much of a stretch, but I'm wondering if in the years after the Civil War, particularly the 1890s, if this founding myth emerges about the Civil War, where Southerners are trying to, as you've explained, trying to explain to themselves how it is they lost that war.
Yeah. Well, it begins with the historical fact that the Confederacy was defeated, truly defeated, conquered, eliminated. Now, if you're the people who brought about that revolution, rebellion, whatever you want to call it, and you lost big time and you've survived it, now you have to explain it.
Yeah.
How do you explain it? How do you justify it? Well, eventually, it's a series of justifications that most white Southerners, not all of them, but most white Southerners and ex-Confederates developed. And part of it was rooted in this idea that their cause was noble, that a losing cause can be the better cause, and it can be defeated by industrialization. It can be defeated by, as Lee put it, superior numbers and resources. It can be defeated by what some called the Yankee Leviathan. They were just overwhelmed by all those troops and all that material. But then also they needed to explain to themselves and to the world what their cause was. What was the Confederacy actually about?
Right.
Well, we know historically. There's just no real debate over this among historians. There is in public memory, but there's no debate anymore that slavery and its future lay at the root of the Civil War. But after the war, the Lost Cause tradition developed this elaborate explanation that they had never really fought for slavery, mm-hmm. that they'd only fought for home, homeland, and sovereignty, self-government, that they'd fought for states' rights and federalism, that they fought only because they were invaded. And ultimately, they found a way then to fold that story into the redevelopment of control, indeed total control by the 1880s and 1890s over race relations. In other words, slavery may be gone, said the average Lost Cause advocate, but it doesn't mean it was wrong. It doesn't mean it wasn't the proper and right place or position for African and black peoples in the world. Now, if slavery has to be gone, what do you replace it with? And this Lost Cause tradition is very much tied up in the development of this American apartheid, this American Jim Crow system, which in its legal sense is implanted by the 1890s and into the early 20th century.
I want to ask you, you've mentioned that in declaration after declaration, Confederate states were pretty straightforward. They were explicit at the time. They seceded in order to preserve slavery. And there's no, as you say, no doubt about that now. And they were clear at the time. But you still have historians, and this comes up. I want to play a clip from Shelby Foote because I know you've
sure.
talked a little bit about this.
Mm-hmm.
This, again, question that he raises here in this moment, and it's a rather long clip, but it'll give us something to talk about, that the Civil
sure.
War wasn't just, in fact, about slavery, that it was, in fact, something much more complicated. Here's
okay.
Shelby Foote.
And you have to translate yourself back into the time of secession to understand how some states should want to secede. The Constitution has not been amended in 61 years. This was the First Amendment, the Emancipation Amendment. It was the First Amendment in 61 years of the Constitution, and absolutely the First Amendment that ever had anything to do with anybody's private property. So they saw this amendment coming. They said, we don't want any part of this union. We want to get out of it. And people who say slavery had nothing to do with the war are just as wrong as the people who say slavery had everything to do with the war. That was a very complicated civic thing. Robert Toombs or somebody once gave the best definition of that war I've ever heard. He said it was a war of one form of society against another form of society. And because one of those forms of society included chattel slavery, and the other side didn't, except to a limited extent, it's always been identified as a war over slavery. Believe me, no soldier on either side gave a damn about the slaves. They were fighting for other reasons entirely in their minds. Southerners thought they were fighting the Second American Revolution. Northerners thought they were fighting to hold the Union together. And that held true throughout the whole war.
What do you hear when you hear that?
Wow. Yeah. That's a lot to respond to.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't want to give you too many.
No, it's quite all right.
But to the general point, maybe. Yes.
Sure, sure. Well, of course it's complicated. And of course there's no utterly single cause of any great world historical moment. But almost everything that Shelby Foote just said, and he said it himself, actually, admitted it, came back to this fact. He used the term society, quoting whomever he couldn't remember there.
Yeah, yeah.
Society, yes. A society rooted in free labor. A society rooted in the idea of the upward mobility of the common man. Sure, it's full of racism in the North, but this idea of free labor ideology, moving west, getting land, the small farmer, the clerk, the nobody immigrant who could make it somehow as a free worker, a free laborer, and make the future better for his son, his daughter, that's a driving ideology of Northerners, and they want the West to remain free from slavery because they know they can't compete with the kinds of oligarchical economy and power that develop around slavery. And in the South, let's remember who controls the South. It's not the non-slaveholders who went to war and died behind Robert E. Lee and Joseph Johnston and so forth. It's the slaveholders, the 350-odd thousand slaveholders who controlled the politics of the South and controlled its cotton kingdom economy. They made no bones about the fact that when they seceded from the Union, it's in every resolution of secession of all of the original seven states that seceded from the Union, and it is again in the four that joined them, that they were seceding to preserve a slave society, to preserve a racial system, to preserve their, quote, way of life, to preserve their property. Jefferson Davis made a speech in late April 1861. This is after Fort Sumter now. The war has begun.
Yeah.
And Davis used the word property in slaves, property in slaves. I don't know. I once counted six, seven times in that speech in a way of explaining. So why are we doing this? What is at stake here? Property in slaves. Now, you know, Mr. Foote is, though, look, he's where he's from.
Yeah.
Shelby Foote had a, you know, was a beautiful writer. And he had that mellifluous voice that Ken Burns used to such a great extent in his documentary film series.
Yeah.
But to say that it's just a complicated civic thing tells you nothing. And if just to say you had two different societies is not to tell you much either. What's the difference in those societies?
Right.
And here's the key thing that I think he said that is so misfitted in this argument and always has been. He claims that no soldier went to war to defend slavery or end slavery. That is just not true. That is just not true. In the first place, 180,000 African Americans were in the Union Army and Navy, and you can rest assured they were interested in ending slavery. But so were eventually a lot of Yankee white Northerners who voted Republican. What that statement refuses to recognize that a person could hold less than savory racial views and still want to destroy slavery because they saw it as the source of this whole conflict, the rebellion, the war to begin with. Thousands of Yankee soldiers ride home from the front, whether that's Virginia or Tennessee or Georgia, and they say this war has to end slavery, otherwise we can't win. Otherwise, we can't conquer the South. Mm-hmm. And the same goes for Confederate soldiers. Yes, the average Confederate soldier did not own slaves, but his society did.
Right.
His government did. His whole economy did. He knew what he was fighting for. He didn't have to say it every day. So why men go fight and what causes wars or causes governments to go to war have always been two quite fundamentally different questions.
Mm.
Shelby Foote there was trying to do what the Lost Cause had always done, which is to deflect this idea that the Confederacy could have existed and pursued a future for a slaveholder's republic. That's really what it was. And we now have two or three new generations of historians who have been showing this, demonstrating this, and arguing this for a long time.
You know, I guess it's understandable that someone like Shelby Foote, rooted where he was, would in the South, that might make some sense. I think what's confusing to me is something that you've pointed it out, which seems like almost a tragic irony, that without the complicity of people in the North—
Right.
This Lost Cause narrative wouldn't have really caught on.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I argued that at great length in the book Race and Reunion, that the Lost Cause arguments, they take new form by the late 19th century and into the early 20th century. Early on, the Lost Cause ideology and tradition was mostly formed by former officers in the Confederate Army, Lee's former lieutenants. They were basically defending their war effort. Now, but by the 1890s, and after the turn of the century, the lost cause ideology is often controlled by women, not exclusively, but often by women and the United Daughters of the Confederacy. And there's a culture that takes hold that says, all right, South is defeated, but in the end, they actually won a victory. And the victory they're celebrating is the victory over Reconstruction, over the experiment in racial democracy that was Reconstruction, over those great constitutional amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th. Yeah. And by declaring that the lost cause is no longer about loss, it's really about a kind of national victory over this racial experiment. Mm-hmm. A lot of Northerners get caught up in that because they, too, are at best worried about race relations and at worst have joined a kind of culture of white supremacy. Yeah. That culture of white supremacy in the North has sometimes as much to do with the massive immigration from Eastern Europe or the Mediterranean world of the late 19th and early 20th century, of all the new kinds of social tensions that have set in American society between labor and capital, between immigrant and native-born, between white people and the so-called Irish race, and so forth and so on. So the North becomes a primary audience for this latter-day kind of lost cause ideology. And indeed, the Robert E. Lee cult takes hold. Yeah. The great Christian soldier who fought for noble ends takes hold by the turn of the century and has many, 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 many Northern advocates of it.
That's the historian David Blight. He's the author of a forthcoming biography of Frederick Douglass. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Not so long ago, White House Chief of Staff General John Kelly called Robert E. Lee an honorable man, said the Civil War was a failure to compromise. But the historian David Blight says that version of the past doesn't match historic fact. He's joining us today to talk about all of this. He's the author of the book Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory. I want to mention Thomas Nelson Page. And I want to play a clip, actually, before we get there. Thomas Nelson Page is this writer, a Northerner, we should point out, who tells these stories about...
Well, he's born in the South.
Born in the South,
In Virginia, but he lives eventually in New York.
Right. And he starts telling these stories. But I want to play a clip. I hope this doesn't seem too out of place, but it's a clip from a Nevada rancher and a fierce opponent of the federal government. And this, his name is Cliven Bundy, took part in this government standoff that you're probably aware of. This was back in 2014. And there's this audio captured from a phone video that where he's giving this press conference from his ranch. And he's talking about his theories regarding race and slavery. Now, mind you, he's a lot further west. He's completely far removed on some level from the ideas of the quote-unquote South, but he's expressing something like this. Let's play this, and I want to have you talk about it.
I want to tell you one more thing I know about the Negro. When I go through Las Vegas, North Las Vegas, and I would see these little government houses, and in front of that government house, the door was usually open, and the older people and the kids. And there's always at least a half a dozen people sitting on the porch. They didn't have nothing to do. They didn't have nothing for their kids to do. They didn't have nothing for their young girls to do. And because they were basically on government subsidy, so now what do? They abort their young children. They put their young men in jail because they never learned how to pick cotton. And I've often wondered, are they better off as slaves picking cotton, having family life and doing things, or are they better off under government subsidy?
Is this a remnant?
Oh God, yes, it is. It's a rapid, fast track leap from the 1890s to 2014.
Yeah, yeah.
with a great deal of history in between that Clive and Bundy, of course, never learned. Black people in that statement to him are either cotton-picking slaves of the 19th century or they're poor people, ill-clad, who can't work and don't work and are sitting on their porches in the early 21st century. There's nothing in between to him. There's no black middle class. There's no millions of educated black people. There's no hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of black elected officials and so on and so forth. But what that's also rooted in is that deep popular culture that set in the late 19th century, which embedded the lost cause in not just this idea that the Confederacy fought for some noble end and Robert E. Lee was a hero, but in this notion of the contented slave, the loyal slave, the laboring happy slave. And that stuff was written by many Southern writers with their Northern publishers and lots of Northern readers, but by no one more than Thomas Nelson Page.
Yeah.
Who wrote one after another of what became known as faithful slave stories, or actually they were known as darky stories. And he traveled the country, particularly in the North, one Chautauqua after another, speaking to hundreds of people at a time, reading his stories in dialect. And what I've argued in many places is that the voice in the ear of so many Northerners, hundreds of thousands of his readers. He was, by the way, the best-selling American author in roughly 1893. Mm-hmm. And the voice in the ear of millions of Americans about the meaning and memory of slavery in the Civil War was the voice of, you know, an Uncle Jimmy, a loyal slave uncle, or Aunt Harriet, the loyal slave woman, saying, oh, gosh, I wish the Yankees hadn't won the war, or gosh, that's a beautiful sunset tonight. I wish we could have back the old times and the old plantation and so on and so forth. Clive and Bundy may or may not have grown up on some of that, Uncle Remus's tales and so forth.
Yeah.
He probably didn't need to, because this is how memory works. It gets into the bloodstream of culture. It gets into the bloodstream of family memory, and then it takes on this politics. What Bundy was saying there to that audience he may have had was good politics for him.
Yeah,
because the real argument there was against government. He kept using the term government subsidy.
Yeah,
his real target there was government itself, and he uses race to attack government. It's an old trick.
Yeah.
And that's what the Confederacy did, too, by the way.
Yeah.
No one else has ever taken it to the extent of the Confederacy, although I guess Bundy led a kind of a very small Confederacy out west.
Yeah. Let me play something. This is – we can work through the particulars, too, but this is generally gets us to the cult of Robert E. Lee, as you describe it. This is General John Kelly.
Right.
Chief of Staff, of course. President Trump. This was in an interview with the television and radio commentator Laura Ingraham.
I would tell you that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days. Now where it's different today. But the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War, and men and women of good faith on both sides made their stand where their conscience had them make their stand.
So there's a lot to get around. Let's talk broadly before we get to the particulars of whether or not, in fact, Robert E. Lee was, or the norm was at the time, for someone to have loyalty to their state rather than the country. Mm-hmm. But just to the general thing that you're hearing there, this is that nobility of Robert E. Lee. And this is something that you say, again, emerges in the, 1890s, I guess.
Right, yeah. Well, it emerges among Southerners even earlier. Lee died in 1870, so he's not around that long to be tarnished by his deeds. Now, honorable man. Yeah. Look, that label on Robert E. Lee is very useful, but it It may fit his basic character in some way, but it does not fit his historical deeds.
Yeah.
By any legal definition, Lee committed treason. I mean, look, if there is any treason, those who held commissions in the United States Army, for God's sake, he had been the commander of West Point. Those who resigned their seats in the U.S. Senate, resigned their positions on the Supreme Court, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to go join the Confederacy. Look, it's a little bit like what Ben Franklin said during the American Revolution: "If this be treason, make the most of it."
Yeah.
Or was that Patrick Henry? I don't know. One of them said that. And you know, so they did. They made the most of it. They attempted their revolution, and they lost big time. But let's reflect on Lee a bit.
Yeah.
He married into most of his slaves. He was deeply concerned about the ones who ran away during his earlier life. But look at it this way, too. Yes, Lee chose to go with his state of Virginia, but that's after he had been asked by the President of the United States and the Secretary of the Army and the Secretary of War to be a commander of the United States forces.
Right.
And he said no. And there's some evidence that he even wanted to know first what kinds of overall strategies the Union government might be devising before he made that decision. Mm. But he made the fateful choice to go with the Confederacy. Now, once he had made it, I guess in the end you could call him honorable because he fought so hard and so long. He was a Confederate nationalist to the very dead end. He knew exactly what the Confederacy stood for. He knew that it stood for the creation and preservation of a slave society and a slaveholder's republic into the future. Lee knew what he fought for. He didn't just fight for military glory. He fought for the existence of the Confederacy. So, you know, after the war, he told people to, you know, give up the cause, that he's at least the cause of independence. But he never strayed on giving in to anything that had to do with African-American rights. And that's a necessary thing to point out.
Yeah.
We love to honor soldiers. But soldiers, as John Kelly would be the first probably to say, are not uneducated. They're not stupid people. They know what they fight for.
Yeah.
And in this case, let's honor Lee for knowing what he fought for, which was the destruction of the American Union and the establishment of two nations on the North American continent, one a permanent slaveholding society.
You've pointed out W.E.B. Du Bois in the 20s wrote a piece about all of this.
Yeah.
It just drove him crazy, this cult of Robert
E. Lee. He
was
sick of it by the 20s. He wrote an essay in the Crisis magazine, "Enough Already," he said, with this honoring of Robert E. Lee. I mean, you know, it was Du Bois' way of saying, where have we come? What has happened to the memory of that event? And he also turned it into an argument for, well, why aren't we honoring Abraham Lincoln more?
Yeah.
For God's sake, the South lost that war. One last thing about Kelly, though. The most disturbing thing in those comments to me, and I've said this a number of places now, was what he said about loyalty to state instead of loyalty to the nation.
Mm-hmm.
That's just dead wrong. I mean, some reporter asked me a bit ago, if I could speak to General Kelly, what would I ask him? And of course, I haven't, and I won't, I'm sure. But I would ask him, has he ever been to the Gettysburg Cemetery? I bet he has. Has he ever looked out on all those graves? Did any of those men fight for their state? Those Union soldiers who died by the droves? Yes, they're buried by markers that label their states. They fought for the nation. They fought for the United States. Has he ever read the Gettysburg Address? What did Lincoln call it? He called it a nation so conceived and so dedicated. This notion that state loyalty was stronger than national or federal loyalty is actually a statement about Confederate loyalty. And John Kelly grew up in Boston, for God's sake.
Yeah.
There we might ask ourselves about the long-term influence of the lost cause.
President Trump, after, there was all of this, you know, this question, of course, has been raised about what we do with Confederate monuments, what we do with the Confederate statues. Right. Of course, President Trump said, you know, is it George Washington next week? Is it Thomas Jefferson the week after that? Because, of course, they had conflicted relationships with slavery. They had slaves, put it explicitly. You've said that the thing that worries you about President Trump is not his authoritarianism, but his essential ignorance about history. Would you talk about that?
You've been reading op-eds I've written. Good.
Yeah.
I have one reader anyway. Sure. From the beginning about Trump's presidency, I mean, I was concerned about a lot of things, who he was going to appoint in agencies to try to destroy some of those agencies, et cetera, et cetera. But I do think the most dangerous thing about a President Trump, especially what we've learned now about the kind of people he surrounds himself with, is his ignorance. Ignorance is an extraordinarily dangerous thing in powerful positions. This is a man who has enormous power, military power, social power, cultural power, power of his voice or his tweets. And he really does not understand the Constitution. He's demonstrated that over and over. I mean, one day he even suggested shutting down a television network. No, sir, you don't have that right. I don't believe he really knows what the Bill of Rights is. He doesn't seem to understand even some of the basics, some of the rituals of foreign policy or diplomacy. He simply behaves and performs as he always has as an individual businessman. But he also just doesn't know any history. To be able to say some of the things he has said about Andrew Jackson, if he had lived, he'd have prevented the Civil War, about Frederick Douglass doing a great job and all that, as though he may not even know who Douglass was. And just whenever he has to reflect on something historical, there's nothing there. You know, what does he know about the Korean War? If we are truly in a brinksmanship with North Korea, what does he actually know about Iran if he's going to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal? What does he even know about the history of the environment and if he's going to remove us from the climate change agreement? You know, every great president has been a reader and a student of history. They all have been. You know, we know this over and over and over. Even George W. Bush, when he was president, he became more of a reader, we're told. Now, his wife, the librarian, may have had something to do with that. But I don't know. I mean, God bless him. He started reading. And, you know, a president has to know a lot of history because a president can make history every day. And you should not have the power ever to make such history if you don't know any.
That's David Blight. He's the author of a forthcoming biography of Frederick Douglass. He's also author of the book Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Why aren't you on Twitter?
Because I'm terrible at Twitter. Sometimes our reporters can sound just a little stiff on air.
Do you not think it's real life?
No, I don't think I do.
Oh.
But like you just heard, Julia Ritchie, she's kind of funny. This is Doug Fabrizio, by the way. You can hear our conversation about Twitter and politics on our new podcast. It's called More to Say. You can download it wherever you get your podcast. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with David Blight. He's a professor of American history at Yale University. In one of your essays in your book, you quote James Baldwin, who said that history is not merely something to be read. He said, it's something that we carry within us, that we're unconsciously controlled by it. It's present in all that we do. Is this what you mean by a collective memory? That we that we have.
Yes, and it's but it's collective and individual. Individual memories make up collective memories.
Yeah.
I mean, there's this old question I've used many times. How do you know a collective memory when you meet one?
Yeah.
Well, it's when you see a group remembering, whether that group is as small as a school or as big as a nation. Yeah, Baldwin had that right. It's not in our blood. It's in our brains. It's in our consciousness. It's in those couple of places in our brains where memory works. It's in the. It's in all those synapses and neurons that allow us to know that we have a past and that we're living out that past, that we're living in a narrative, we're living in a story. As I said earlier, we all walk around with a sense of the past in our minds and hearts. And a lot of this is emotion as much it is as it is. It's emotional passion as much as it is intellect. That's another difference between memory and history. Memory is often about the emotive, about feelings, about, I mean, what is nationalism but a set of feelings, a set of beliefs and feelings wrapped around a sense of peoplehood? And it's not always evil. I mean, it's pretty hard to resist it sometimes. But yeah, we are creatures of the past we have and creatures of the past we choose.
How do you undo, if that's even possible? How do you separate, you know, all of the impacts and the influence of culture, all of the impacts that plug into memory? How do you separate that so we can tease that out and get more at historical truth, if that's even possible, I guess?
Well, that is the task, isn't it?
Yeah.
Historians want to believe we can do it by writing. We have to believe that to some extent. We want to reach readers and audiences, and we're trying, some of us, especially when we get a little older and are comfortable in our jobs, to reach broader and broader and broader audiences. But the truth is we have to get beyond even writing. We have to do what you and I are doing right now on the public airwaves. We have to make documentary films. We have to engage the political process. We have to help when asked, and even sometimes when not asked. We have to help people get their grounding and their footing about the nature of the past. And when somebody like when General Kelly spoke out a few weeks ago about the Civil War, it was amazing what a media furor there was over that.
Yeah.
Because people in this country care. If we don't care about what caused the Civil War and its meaning, then what are we going to care about? It's the pivot of our history. It's what brought about the remaking of the nation state. It brought about the emancipation of 4 million slaves and the redefinition of what liberty, freedom, and rights actually are. And if the chief of staff of the President of the United States, who's a Marine general, doesn't really understand it, we have a problem. And so all kinds of historians were weighing in and weighing in and weighing in. And then we get attacked back, you know, for being elitist and all of that. Although a lot of us also got a lot of favorable mail about that, people thanking us for stepping in. So, you know, you have to it's a long term. You got to play long game on this. We have made tremendous strides, directly to your question. On this question of Civil War memory, if you go back 25 years, on American understandings of slavery, go back 30 years, 40 years, we have made tremendous strides in the way that scholarship and the rewriting of history have now filtered into textbooks, filtered into school curriculums, filtered into summer teacher institutes for teachers, and hundreds of thousands of teachers are involved in these now, as long as they're affordable. So, you know, Americans, if their eyes are open and they're in decent schools, are growing up now with a different history to learn than there was, say, when I was in school a long time ago. Although I had great teachers, I will say, none of the great changes in scholarship, particularly about black history, African-American experience, were even available to the high school teachers I had. I didn't really learn any African-American history until I went to college. I actually took the first ever African-American history survey course taught at Michigan State, where I was an undergraduate, in I think 1970, or it could have been 69. It was the first time I ever taught it.
Yeah.
And I took it, and wow, I didn't know this. Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, wow, what is the Dred Scott case? Ooh, look at that. So, you know, a lot has changed, and it's come about because of a massive collective educational effort, and much of that has come from research universities. So people ought to be careful how much they like to hate these so-called Eastern elites. I didn't go to Yale. I just work here. But there's a lot of interesting history being written here by my colleagues.
I guess the question, where you come down on the question of Confederate monuments or Confederate statues. Mm-hmm. I read the legal historian, Alfred Brophy, said that when you remove a monument, it facilitates forgetting that there once was these, you know, racist ideas, that there was this racial ideology. Where are you on that?
Well, that can happen. Al has a point. You got to be careful about just removal. And there's a lot of sentiment out there. I've been on numerous panels and given talks hinder and yon over the last 2-3 months. And sometimes the people who get up in Q&A are saying, just get rid of them.
Yeah.
All Confederate monuments are about white supremacy, ipso facto, end of debate. That's not an option.
Yeah.
Partly because all of these monuments, if they're important at all, particularly if they're in civic spaces, public civic spaces, they were put up by a politics. They have to come down through a politics. You have to be willing to do the local nitty-gritty work. There needs to be a commission. There needs to be a city council. There needs to be somebody who sits, does the research, and examines who put this monument up, when was it put up, what did it mean then, what does it mean now. Now, do you erase by removal? Sometimes. But it doesn't have to be that way. You can move without removing. You can reposition without erasing. That's possible. You can also leave a monument where it is. And who knows? This may be what could turn out to happen in, of all places, Richmond, which, of course, has Monument Avenue, the biggest array of Confederate monuments in one place anywhere, except, I guess, for Stone Mountain outside Atlanta. But you could leave most or all of those monuments, but you could also create new memorials and new forms of memorials. Memorials are always acts of imagination, and they don't all have to be a man on horseback.
Yeah.
There were 4 million American slaves freed in that war. There were hundreds of thousands of soldiers killed on both sides. Maybe we need some kind of turn toward the elegiac, toward the more collective sense of the results of that war, the painful, tragic, in some cases horrible process that it took to free 4 million people from centuries of bondage, the process that it took to then reimagine a new country in the new constitutional amendments, even though it was largely betrayed in the 19th century, it was still there and revived again in the civil rights era. Even down to the local level and the small monuments, if you have a Confederate soldier on a town square or a town green somewhere in the South, and there are hundreds of them, why not leave it there but put up on that green, if you can afford it, a monument to the local black churches? How did black folk survive that Jim Crow era when most of those monuments were built as celebrations of that Jim Crow era?
Yeah.
They survived in their churches. And maybe there's a way in a lot of those towns that the churches could come together and the civic resources could support them, and they might make a monument to the, who knows, the 5 Protestant churches or Catholic churches or whatever in that community by which black people built their lives and built communities and survived. And many of those churches are still there. So there are other things we need to apply our memorial imagination to. Other than just removal and recreation, or removal and replacement. I also just think people have to be more deliberative.
Yeah.
They need to do this with a sense of humility, because in 50 years or 100 years, we too will be judged about what we did in this moment. People are going to look back at us, and they're going to say, what in the world were they doing? They took down all these monuments over here, and they didn't take them down over there. That city did it. This city didn't. What in the world was going on? Some mayors reacted overnight. Some had a deliberative process. And the last thing we need to do, and it's actually happening to a degree, I think the best thing that's come out of this, in fact, is that people need to learn more history.
Yeah.
These monuments have actually, you know, the monument conversation, if that's what it is allowed a lot of people, if they wish to know when these monuments went up. 75% of them went up in the Jim Crow era. In many cases, they were symbols of white supremacy. You honored the Confederacy as a means of honoring the racial system you had then. Learning that is itself, you know, a kind of a victory for knowledge. Now, where do we take it from there? We need to be deliberative. We need more humility. We need to learn more history.
I think you've pointed out that the root of ignorance is ignore. This idea of engaging in this question seems important.
Exactly. I've tried to make that case even about President Trump, you know, that the root of the word ignorance is ignore, especially for people in power who have the means to know or to gain knowledge, to be more informed. I mean, this is the ideal, isn't it, of education. The more informed we are, the better citizens will be. Well, it doesn't always work that way. Often because memory intrudes, people choose the past they want. They choose the past they want to live in the present. And we can't really change that. That's part of the human condition. But we can just keep fighting it.
That's David Blight. He's a professor of American history at Yale University. He's the author of Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory. He also has a new biography of Frederick Douglass, which is coming out soon. You can visit us at RadioWest.org for links to his other articles and essays. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Anthony Scoma. We had technical direction from Michael Havey, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.